Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome, I'm Mark Bayshore. On the way today, we take a look at the other Asian carp, grass carp, and the threat it poses to the Great Lakes. Also, the art of the selfie, the impromptu self-portraits you take with your digital camera or cell phone. To start out our Tuesday program, mention the phrase stock exchange to most people and they'll likely visualize Wall Street, the home of the New York Stock Exchange, the world's biggest. But smaller regional stock exchanges are nothing new. For 70 years until the mid-1970s, Detroit had its own stock exchange. It's credited with speeding the growth of General Motors and dozens of other Michigan companies. A proposal to allow local stock exchanges in Michigan was recently filed in the state legislature. The aim is to allow citizens to invest in smaller, promising Michigan companies that may not qualify for a larger exchange. Yesterday, I spoke with two guests who support the proposal, State Rep. Andy Shore of Lansing and Summer Minnick, Director of Policy Initiatives and Federal Affairs for the Michigan Municipal League. I first asked Representative Shore to explain how the local stock exchange would work.
Well, it's very similar to the way the stock exchange works nationally. You have companies that are traded on an exchange publicly, except this would be Michigan companies that would be traded. It would be a chance to kind of promote those companies, to trade them publicly here within our state. So we're going to hype up these great Michigan companies, and let's keep it local. That's the concept, and I think the Tax Policy Committee is going to work out some of the details as you look at how it meshes with the federal stock exchanges. But the concept is to really help our local businesses by letting them be publicly traded on a Michigan-based stock exchange.
And Summer Minnick, the proposal, which the Michigan Municipal League is also supporting, is on the heels of a new crowdfunding law signed by Governor Snyder back in January. Remind us what that crowdfunding law does.
Sure. It's a very exciting new economic development tool, which is an opportunity for entrepreneurs and talented small businesses to really generate additional capital by going out to local investors to raise money that they might not be able to in a traditional atmosphere.
And they're both in loose terms crowdfunding. You're both trying to mobilize public investment money towards one particular venture or another. But how would the operations of the stock exchange differ from crowdfunding?
Well, in crowdfunding, you can go out and put investments in. So say you could give $500 or $1,000 to a local brew pub or a local retail establishment, knowing that at some point you're going to get a 25 or 50% return, but it could be over 5 or 7 years because of how long it takes them to generate that much revenue. Well, a local stock exchange would allow that to have more liquidity. So it's really a good complement to crowdfunding because then if for some reason an investor might be interested in putting $500 or $1,000 towards that local business, but they're not so comfortable waiting 5 years, this gives them the opportunity to trade it and have their money back at some point.
Andy, what's been the buzz on the stock exchange proposal? Does it appear to enjoy a lot of the support that the crowdfunding measure did?
I think so. I think it's the next logical evolution of the crowdfunding idea. Representative Nancy Jenkins has spearheaded both of these bills, and I've co-sponsored both. I think that there are a lot of people who are trying to look out of the box in terms of funding, in terms of helping out our businesses, our entrepreneurs, providing avenues, especially coming out of the recession where financing and liquidity was so hard to get. These are unique tools. So as the Tax Policy Committee looks at the local stock exchange, again, the devil's always in the details. So we took the crowdfunding and we had to make some changes, and the Senate made some changes, but we got it. We got it to the governor, and I think the same thing is happening with the local stock exchange bill. I think that it will continue to see some action and kind of have the details worked out, but the concept will stay the same. Like Summer explained, it will ensure that these companies can get investors, and then that those companies can be traded on the market. The investors can get their money back, or they can trade it just like they would on a national stock exchange. So I think that it's having some buzz, and we'll continue to work it through and get it to the governor hopefully soon, get it to the Senate soon, and then to the governor.
Presumably, a stock exchange or even more than one would require regulation. Already some are suggesting that's a critical factor and that the state might not be up to it. Does that concern you as well, Summer?
Well, I think that, as Andy alluded to, there's always details that need to be worked out, but we're confident that this is something that we can overcome in the legislative process, and it's something that the state will be able to regulate. Certainly worked into the legislation, the state would have the ability to oversee any entity that wants to open an exchange. So we're confident that this will be overcome.
And all the same risks for investors that are involved with buying equities on a larger established stock exchange would still apply here, correct?
Mm-hmm.
We had the Corporation Securities and Commercial Licensing Bureau within the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs. That's a mouthful.
But LARA,
they've been involved the whole way. And the governor wouldn't sign it if the state didn't have the ability to regulate it. So I think we're in good shape.
What do you envision, Summer? If this thing unfolds positively here, do you envision a scattered number of exchanges, a statewide Michigan stock exchange? What?
Well, based on some preliminary research that we've done, we think a statewide exchange would probably be the most likely outcome, although the bill doesn't, you know, stipulate a requirement one way or the other. But you sort of need a larger geographic area in order to capture enough businesses to make it successful. So the ones that haven't been successful in other countries have been sort of countywide. So we anticipate that something along the lines of a statewide or at least large metropolitan scale regional would probably be the most successful.
We're talking with Summer Minnick of the Michigan Municipal League and State Rep Andy Shore about a proposal that would allow the formation of local stock exchanges in Michigan. Is it clear what kind of rules might govern a company's inclusion on such an exchange? I guess I'm wondering how local might a company be in order to become a part of a local stock exchange?
I think a lot of that's going to be worked out as we work through the bills in the legislature. I think that, you know, we'll look at the national model. We'll look at and see what other areas have done and see what has worked and what hasn't. I think some of that still has yet to be worked out. We talk about the devils in the details. I think part of that is still to be worked out. And again, the administration, I'm sure, will weigh in on what they think is appropriate.
But clearly, this is intended to support small businesses throughout Michigan and entrepreneurs and startups. So we think that this will be pretty widely applicable.
So whereas a company to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange mm-hmm. needs some kind of market capitalization in the millions or billions or trillions or whatever, we're obviously talking smaller scale here.
Much smaller.
Summer, your boss, Dan Gilmartin, wrote recently that Michigan would be the first in the nation to adopt a state stock exchange. Would there be an advantage to being number one?
Well, I think that's why we're so intrigued by this proposal, is the idea that Michigan and Michigan communities can really go out and promote themselves as hotbeds for entrepreneurs and those that are interested in startups or expanding their businesses, that we now, as cities and villages in Michigan, have the opportunity to promote tools that nobody else has. So we really think it's a exciting opportunity for us to lure those people and encourage our citizens to invest on Main Street rather than Wall Street.
Are other states considering these, though?
There are a few. I believe Wisconsin is one of them that's considering it right now. So
I want to ask both of you what you're thinking regarding the plan, which so far has enjoyed bipartisan support, to make municipalities recoup revenue after a revocation of the PPT, the personal property tax. Is this a done deal, Andy?
I think it's very close. I do. I think when the original legislation was passed about two years ago, a lot of the Democrats voted no because the legislation only required an 80% recapture for localities, for municipalities exempting police and fire, and I think that the business community did not want to see folks voting no. They wanted to see a bipartisan effort that everybody could support going into August. And that's what this legislation before us does now. It makes the municipalities whole. It allows them to capture 100% back of what they were getting when they were able to collect the full personal property tax. I think that, this legislation has gotten to a point where, you know, you had at a press conference, we had Rebecca Warren, Senator Rebecca Warren, and myself standing up along with the manufacturers and with several Republican senators in support of the bills. So I think the lieutenant governor and I think that Democrat and Republican leadership have been able to come together on this one and get it right before we get into August and have a vote on the personal property tax repeal.
So in August, voters will decide whether or not to revoke it. But in the meantime, the legislature and supporters of the revocation are trying to make clear this is how you will get your revenue back after we cut this.
Correct.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Will the electorate support revocation of the PPT?
You know, I think that when there's no opposition and you have an effective campaign from the business community and the cities and the townships and the counties and the police and fire, when everybody comes together and says, vote for this, if there's not opposition, I think that they can be very convincing to the electorate that this is the right thing to do. If there would have been an organized opposition, then it would have been an uphill fight. But with this legislation passing and all of the organizations that were either neutral or had concerns now coming on board, I think the case can be made to the electorate that this is the right thing to do for Michigan moving forward.
Summer, what's the view of the league on this?
Well, we've enjoyed very successful negotiations with the administration and the legislature on this. Our concern from the very beginning was the long-term fiscal health of our communities and ensuring that we didn't suffer our ability to provide essential services and attract talent. I mean, we've just been talking about ways that cities can be more attractive. So we obviously have that on the forefront of our mind, and we wanted to make sure that we could continue to support essential services and not lose the revenue. So the fact that we've come so far and now we're looking at 100% reimbursement is something that we're very happy with.
Your Michigan Municipal League Capital Conference is today and tomorrow in Lansing. What policy debates are you most interested in moving forward during your gathering?
Well, one of the issues that I'm most excited about is we have Mayor Ralph Becker from Salt Lake City, Utah, who is speaking both at a House public transportation hearing tomorrow and at our general session, our lunch tomorrow, about public transit and how they built it from the ground up in Salt Lake City. And we think that that's something really exciting for him to share his experience in a very conservative state of how you can convince all parties of the economic value of public transit. And he has actual economic data that he'll be sharing about the benefit of public transit for Salt Lake City.
Speaker Bolger, Tim Grimmel will also be speaking. You got quite a lineup.
We do. It'll be great. People should attend.
Summer Minnick is Director of Policy Initiatives and Federal Affairs for the Michigan Municipal League. Andy Shore represents Lansing in the State House. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. Most people have heard about Asian carp and the threat they pose to the Great Lakes. However, many don't understand what the label Asian carp means. There are many types of fish that fall under the Asian carp umbrella, each bringing their own unique peril to the Great Lakes Basin. One type of Asian carp that's overlooked and underestimated is the grass carp. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Sea Grant educator Dr. Dan O'Keefe about the other Asian carp.
I think that when people hear Asian carp, they're typically referencing, they think they're referencing a singular type of fish. However, there are many types of carp that fall into this Asian carp group. Explain.
That's a great point because, you know, I've been commenting for a while that the term Asian carp really doesn't mean much. There are a lot of different carp species in Asia and four specifically that we have in U.S. waters. So the two that we think of most often are the bighead and silver carp, and they tend to get lumped together because they both eat plankton, and we kind of expect that their impacts will involve eating the little stuff that our native baby fish need. So they're eating plankton. But there's also a black carp and a grass carp headed our way, and they all kind of fit into this Asian carp term. So the grass carp in particular is has already been found in Michigan waters, for one, and it has completely different effects. So when we think about the damage that Asian carp can potentially produce, it's really a different thing when we're talking about grass carp.
Going back to the big head and the silver carp, why have these garnered so much more attention than, say, the grass carp?
Well, I got to think that YouTube has something to do with it. You see those silver carp jumping out of the water and hitting people in the face, and you know, it's almost funny if it wasn't so sad at the same time when you think of not only the impact because of their plankton guzzling ability and the potential to hurt our native fish, but also recreation. You know, they're a direct impact, literally, on people. So the silver carp, again, tends to get lumped in with the big head carp. We'll say, oh, they're a jumping fish that tends to get over 100 pounds. And really, the big head carp tends to be the bigger of the two species and more likely to get up into that 100-pound range, whereas a lot of the silver carp that you see videos of jumping are maybe in the 5 to 20-pound range. Still, they pack quite a punch, but you don't really see 100-pound fish jumping out of the water.
Terrifying is what that is.
Yeah.
So we understand kind of the dangers of big head and silver carp. So what about grass carp? What potential impact could they have on the Great Lakes?
Well, if you think about the Great Lakes first, we tend to think of the Great Lakes in terms of these big, clear, kind of cold bodies of water. And those aren't necessarily the areas that any of these species are going to be most problematic in. It's really the bays, the connected rivers, the really productive areas that are along the sides and connecting waters of the Great Lakes proper. So that's the first thing to kind of wrap your head around is places like Saginaw Bay or Lake St. Clair, Western Lake Erie, Drowned River Mouth Lakes. And when you have bodies of water like that are more nutrient-rich than the cold, deep Great Lakes proper, then you have a dynamic where you kind of toggle back and forth between two possibilities. And one is a lot of rooted vegetation, so lots of what we would call weeds on the bottom growing up to the surface in some instances. You either have that because you have sunlight and nutrients, or you have lots and lots of algae in the water, what we call phytoplankton, that just gives the water kind of a greenish, mucky look to it. So the difference here is that Asian carp can have one of two effects and push it either way. They can either, in the case of big head and silver carp, eat all of that plankton and potentially reduce the amount of suspended phytoplankton. So they clear up the water and potentially lead to more growth of what we call weeds. Then we have the grass carp that do the opposite. They eat what we would call the weeds, the rooted plants, but they don't digest them very well. So they're going to eat a tremendous amount of vegetation. But like most fish, they can't do a great job of digesting it. So a lot of that plant matter just passes right through them and comes out the other side and, in effect, fertilizes the water. So they convert a weedy kind of clear water situation into a situation where there's very little weed growth and a real mucky look to the water.
And how might that impact other aspects of the environment, whether it's other animals or other plant life?
Well, for the grass carp, if they're getting rid of those rooted plants, some people obviously say, oh, great, you know, these weeds, they get stuck on my feet when I go swimming, and they catch in the propeller of boats. So the reason grass carp have been stocked so much down south, especially, is to try to get rid of what people consider nuisance weed growth. But those weeds are really important for a lot of wildlife and fish, and an intermediate density of the weeds is generally considered good for a lot of different organisms. Birds, waterfowl feed on a variety of different native aquatic plants especially, and fish use those areas as nurseries. Early in their life, small fish need to be able to hide from bigger fish. And it's not so much that the fish are getting anything directly from the plants in terms of feeding on them, but it's providing that structure to the environment that they need to avoid predators early in life. So you see that the plant growth, the weeds, really play kind of an intermediate role in structuring fish communities and populations.
When were grass carp brought to the U.S. and they were essentially brought to try and clear up some of these weeds, was the idea?
Well, yeah, if you look at the way that they're used in their native range, in Eastern Asia and China. They're used in polyculture. So they actually use all these Asian carps that we're talking about here in the U.S. together in ponds, because between them all, they'll eat everything. So they can get really high yields out of these ponds if they stock grass carp, bighead carp, black carp, common carp, and silver carp all together. Between them all, they'll eat everything in the environment. So when they were brought here originally, we had the idea that we could start using these biological controls instead of chemical controls for the various things that we'd like to change in certain water bodies. And the grass carp, again, specifically was for the rooted plants. But they were brought in the late 60s and early 1970s. And they got pretty widespread use in southern canals, golf course ponds, fish farms, a variety of applications where you have shallow waters that are really productive and you have light penetrating to the bottom, so you get a lot of that weed growth.
So you said that they have found grass carp in the Great Lakes, but do they have established breeding populations at this point, or are we kind of unsure as to what the actual population is or how many are in the Great Lakes?
Well, that's a really important point, because so often we hear people say, the sky is falling, it's over, we've lost the battle with all the Asian carp because they've already gotten into the Great Lakes. And with the grass carp, they've certainly gotten into the Great Lakes. And the question of established breeding populations is really getting some attention recently because of a study on a few specimens that were caught in the Sandusky Bay, Lower Sandusky River area in Ohio. And that's a tributary, of course, of Lake Erie. And they were small fish that were caught by commercial fishermen. And when scientists looked at the otoliths, the ear stones in the head of the grass carp, they were able to determine that those fish had spent their whole life in that watershed, which pretty much can be taken to mean that they were spawned there. And that was the first evidence of any of the Asian carp species successfully reproducing in the Great Lakes Basin. So is that the same as saying they're an established breeding population? At this point, you could probably argue it either way. It's evidence of natural reproduction, but it's not necessarily evidence that there's a large and sustainable breeding population yet, but it's definitely cause for concern and has a lot of people focused on this possibility that we may see it in the near future. We might see the establishment of a breeding population that gets to the point where we can't control it.
Right now, there's essentially a kind of patchwork of policies. The Army Corps study just came out about solutions to try and keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes' larger populations. I mean, nothing really can... I don't want to seem hopeless, but is there much more to be done, or we're still kind of in the process of figuring out what to do or how to deal with this?
Well, in some, it's a big question when you get into the policy.
Yeah.
Michigan has honestly been a bit ahead of the curve because they've prohibited grass carp stockings and use for a long time and have actually enforced that in a few occasions, including last year when a shipment of grass carp was confiscated up in Midland, Michigan. Someone had driven in from another state and was trying to sell them for people to stock in ponds, because people have ponds with weeds and they hear that grass carp are used elsewhere, and then it's an incentive for people to come in and illegally, intentionally distribute them. So that's a different pathway than what we usually think about with Asian carp in Chicago area waterways. However, grass carp are also in those waterways and they're reproducing there. So they're reproducing in the same areas of the Illinois River downstream from Chicago that the bighead and silver carp are, and in fact they're more abundant than bighead and silver carp in Chicago proper. So that's still a pathway of concern for grass carp in my book. But there are other pathways that are important too. So I don't like to paint a kind of a doom and gloom picture, really, because of the amount of attention that's been focused on this. I think there have been some significant strides made, and there's even a bill in now to up the fines for intentional sale and transport of nuisance species in Michigan. So that's one of the issues, is if we have these laws and we even have enforcement, we still need a penalty that's big enough to disincentivize people actually breaking the law and trying to get away with it. So I think there has to be progress on many different fronts, and we are seeing that. We're seeing different approaches to different pathways. One of them is the sale of organisms in trade, and of course the direct hydrologic connections, like Chicago area waterways, are a different set of problems and different set of potential solutions.
Dr. Dan O'Keefe is a Sea Grant educator. Dan, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A documentary filmmaker from India will be in East Lansing for a screening of his latest movie tonight. Current State Scott Pohl is here with a preview. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. This filmmaker is named Sanjay Kak, and his latest is called Red Ant Dream. It's a reflection on modern-day revolution in India. The MSU College of Arts and Letters will screen the film on campus tonight, and Kak will be there. Red Ant Dream is the third in a cycle of films, so I started by asking Sanjay Kak about the first two of these documentaries.
Words in Water was a film that is set in the Narmada Valley of central India, where for almost two decades there has been a very vibrant and important movement against large dams. And the Save the Narmada movement actually developed into quite an international phenomenon because, amongst other things, they were the first social movement that actually persuaded the World Bank to withdraw its support for a large dam. So Words on Water was finished in 2002, and it looked at what happens in a democracy, which is ostensibly what India is, what happens in a democracy when very large numbers of people decide that a certain project, in this case a dam, they just simply don't want it because it's quite clear to them that it brings them no benefits and it causes them great loss, you know. So that was in 2002. And then I followed it up in 2007 with another long feature-length film called Jashn-e-Azadi, which the English sort of subtitle of it is How We Celebrate Freedom. And this was a film that looked at what was happening in the north of India, in Kashmir, where for at least 25 years, there has been a very, very major resistance, a separatist resistance, and which was, where it turned into an armed rebellion in 1990. And of course, it has a much older history, a history that goes back to the partition of India, British India, to 1947. So together, both these films were looking at very different aspects of democracy in India, but taking a critical view about what are the ways in which democracy has actually transpired in India, as opposed to how we imagine it to have worked out.
Red Ant Dream, then, is the third film in this cycle. Is it meant to be a trilogy, or will there be more films?
Well, I suppose, it wasn't planned as a trilogy, but when Red Ant Dream was finished, it was hardly for me to see it as a trilogy, but I think some other people began to see that there was a certain a landscape that the three films collectively covered. So yes, in a sense, it is a trilogy, but it's not complete in any sense because the argument with Indian democracy and how it plays out is, as you can imagine, an endless one in a country of 1.2 billion people. So there could be more films. Perhaps I might not be necessarily the person to make those films, but I think that this is a conversation which will go on.
Please explain the title Red Ant Dream and give us a synopsis of this new film.
The film is set or takes its sparks off from central India in what is called Chhattisgarh. It's a state very much in the heart of India. It's very rich in forests, and it's populated largely by what we call Adivasis or indigenous people. And it's also extremely rich in mineral resources. And as you can imagine, this is quite an explosive combination because, you know, where forests sit atop mineral reserves, then you can be pretty sure that very soon somebody will want those forests to disappear. And India is not the only place this has happened in or where it will happen again. So the difference is that when mining companies started moving in, the resistance by the indigenous people very quickly got conflated with what we call the Maoists, who are extreme left-wing group. And so the Maoist resistance to the entry of the Indian state into those forests is where the film begins. And then it moves to other parts of eastern India, where there are similar resistances to mining, except they may not be armed. They may not take the form of an armed rebellion. So that's the ground of the film. But what it really is a reflection on what we call the revolutionary ideal in India. And if I can just take a moment to say that, you know, we ask ourselves that what or who is a revolutionary? And I think our definition while working on this film is that, you know, revolutionaries are those who don't accept that the world has to be the way it is, you know, that we are not here only to tinker and improve it, but, you know, we really do want to change the way things are. And I think when an Adivasi or an indigenous person in the forests of Bastar refuses to move and give up his land and his life, because somebody wants to mine the iron ore that his home is sitting on, that is a revolutionary act, you know. And so that's what the film is an examination of. It's an exploration of the revolutionary ideal in India. And it's called Red Ant Dream, partially as an act of some whimsy, and partially because there are red ants in the film. And also because there is a dream of another world embedded somewhere within the film as well.
I want to talk with you about a couple of people who we learn about in the film. One is Bhagat Singh, who was a revolutionary who was executed in 1931, and the poet Pash, who was assassinated in 1988. Red Ant Dream shows people who connect their deaths on the same date, referring to them as the martyrs of 23 March. What connects Bhagat Singh and Pash besides the dates of their deaths?
You know, Bhagat Singh is a very, very important figure in the public imagination of India. He was 23, as you have figured, when he was sentenced to death by the British. But already he had taken up a huge place in the imagination of young Indians because he was, in exactly the same ways that I have said to you earlier, he was a revolutionary. He, in his case, unlike the other figures involved in the national movement, figures such as Mahatma Gandhi or Jawaharlal Nehru, they were not interested in accommodating or coming to an arrangement with the British over the independence of India. So he continues to his image, the image of this 23-year-old, and he's sometimes shown in a hat, carrying a revolver in his hand. He's sometimes shown in a yellow turban, but he was a very good-looking young man who left behind a small body of very impressive text, you know, very brief. And he was a socialist. He was a self-confessed communist. And yet he remains an inspiring figure for people across the intellectual landscape of India. So that was Bhagat Singh. Pash was a young, very angry poet who wrote in the late 60s, 60s and early 70s. This very angry, acidic kind of poetry, which was a very, very blistering critique of Indian society as it had developed in the years after independence. And of course, he came in the same sort of, let's say, the genealogy from which Bhagat Singh came. And I mean, I'm not the person who actually put the two together, because in the state of Punjab, which is in North India, which is where Pash came from, which is where Bhagat Singh came from, people have been celebrating now for many years the anniversary of their death, and in a sense, making a kind of connection with the past. Bhagat Singh, you know, from the 1930s, Pash in the early 70s, and then I use that connection to present it with the present. So that's the reason why these sort of links are made.
We also hear the voice of a Maoist named Azad, who's described in your film as the voice of the Communist Party of India.
Violence is a structural feature of our society. It is an inbuilt, inherent characteristic of the existing unjust, authoritarian, hierarchical, oppressive, and rotten society.
Tell me the role of Azad in your film, Red Ant Dream.
Well, you know, like many people who are part of the Communist Party of India Maoist, which is a banned party in India, so it's anybody who's part of the party is underground, and obviously there's no overt contact with them. Azad was their spokesperson, the official spokesperson for the party. And of course, there was no way that I could meet him. But we obtained a long audio interview of his, which later was available in the public domain as well, which is a very, very impressive and coherent and persuasive. It reflected a very cohesive and coherent vision of what they saw they were engaged in, as opposed to the popular depiction of these people as just some crazy, you know, heart of darkness, kind of mad Maoists in the forest. So I use that audio in the film in order to give the viewers a sense of who are these guys in the forest? What do they believe in? What do they think? What are they saying? You know, and of course, tragically, before the film could be finished, Azad was actually drawn out of the forest by the Indian government through negotiators in order to begin a process of negotiating some kind of arrangement. And of course, he was killed in what the police claimed was an encounter. That's the word that is used in India. But all evidence pointed to the fact that he was eliminated in a cold-blooded killing. So in a sense, that voice of rationality that you hear in the film met a terrible fate. You know, he came out in order to negotiate a peace, but was killed.
The Michigan State University College of Arts and Letters will screen Red Ant Dream, part of their global film series, at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday in room B122 of Wells Hall on the MSU campus. Director and writer Sanjay Kak will be there for a question and answer session after the screening. Sanjay Kak, thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Scott, for a wonderful conversation.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
MSU's Cello Plus series has grown into one of the state's most significant chamber music gatherings, bringing together performers and composers from around the world during the week-long festival. On Wednesday night, series founder Seren Bagratuni and others will perform the music of Armenian visiting composer Vache Sharafian. Sharafian's sound often combines traditional instruments and Armenian tunes with a deeply spiritual approach. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with both Bagratuni and Sharafian late last week. Their conversation began with Vache Sharafian recalling an early contact with Seren Bagratuni.
Our first meeting was on phone. One day I had a phone call, and it was Seren Bagratuni from States. I was in Yerevan, and he decided to come and ask me that he wants to that I would write a concerto for him. Yeah, and I wrote my first cello concerto dedicated to Suren Bagratuni that was premiered here in Michigan State University, and later also in Armenia. I did, in the same time, I wrote two versions of this concerto with a big symphony orchestra and chamber orchestra strings. So the chamber choral version was premiered in Armenia, and the original symphony version in Michigan State University, here conducted by Leon Gregorian, and in Armenia by Aram Garabekian. And that was our first collaboration, and it resulted more and more new compositions that I did for Suren.
Yeah. Suren, were you involved in the compositional process in some way, or was this a complete work that was just presented to you for performance?
During the first concerto, I never am involved because, first of all, I completely trust Bace. He knows how to write for instruments, very idiomatic writing. After the concerto, when I commissioned a cycle of pieces, I asked him if you can to make it sounding as if they would be old Armenian songs, sacred songs. And because Vache is a specialist in that area, so he used some of old Armenian tunes, probably even maybe one measure worth of tune, and then he collaborated on that. So that's how the four pieces were created, two of them for cello and piano, and two of them for two cellos. But the last one, Amen Holy Father, it's for two cellos, and both players have to sing during the performance. For me, that was it was written before even all those famous pieces written by Vasks, etc., etc. He already used that technique, and we fortunately we were able to record those pieces, and it's on the CD right now.
Right, Vache Sharafian's music is featured on your most recent CD.
Pieces include written for us, we commissioned with James Forger, Dean of the College, who's a wonderful saxophone player. We commissioned jointly from Vache, he wrote for us the duo for saxophone and cello, which we premiered here in again in Lansing, East Lansing. Then it includes two pieces which we recorded with Deborah Moriarty again here for the cello and piano. Both were based on the ancient sacred Armenian songs. And recently, I'm very proud to say that my daughter Marta, in her latest project, commissioned a piece from Vache. And, you know, I was so jealous because he wrote for her incredible piece, which called Gem Rose. And that piece is unbelievably beautiful. And I said, how come you write for her something like that and not for me? So it was just...
Why did you do that?
No, because also Marta, Soren's daughter, is a very nice singer. And it was special for her voice and her playing. I'm very proud that it succeed.
Vache, you've been associated with Seren and many other world-renowned musicians. Your music is known by the Hilliard Ensemble, Anna Kiko Myers, the violinist, the Avalon String Quartet, wonderful violist Yuri Bashmet, and you're also known for your association with the Silk Road Project, Yo-Yo Ma's group, which travels across the U.S. and around the world with music that connects Eastern and Western traditions, really music, global music. Tell me how you first got involved with Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Project.
Oh, yeah, thanks. One day I had a call, the person says that some great cellist, Yo-Yo Ma, want to meet you. It was like a joke or what? So they commissioned Yo-Yo Ma commissioned me to write another piece for Duduk and String Quartet, which I called Morning Scent of the Acacia Song. Mm-hmm. And the piece I wrote much before that was The Sun, the Wine, and the Wind of Time.
Yes. And these ideas of connection from place to place, from one type of music to another, and these notions of suspension of time.
Yes.
Those inform works like Sun, Wind, and Wind of Time.
Yes, these words are very connected together, mm-hmm. like wine and sun and wind, something that brings to some picture that always by wind can be destroyed and mm-hmm. can start to move, something like that. And the wine that is making under the sun, grapes, and this is very popular for Caucasian nation and for duduk players because they always duduk is something that accompany Armenians through all their life, starting from a birth time, and weddings are the baptizings even and up the funerals.
It's an instrument, but it's a voice.
It's like it sounds like a human voice.
Yeah.
It was pronounced. Proclaimed masterpiece of human intangible treasures by UNESCO. By the way, by my program and Georg Dabagyan's collaborative program in 2006, it was proclaimed a masterpiece.
By way of Armenia, that was music of Vache Sharafian on WKAR. Vache will be a visiting composer here as part of the Cello Plus series this week at Michigan State University, and his music is going to be performed Wednesday night, along with many musicians, including the organizer of Cello Plus, professor of cello, Seren Bagratuni. Seren, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Vache, thanks for visiting Michigan State University.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State on WKAR. Next week, a new project will encourage girls to redefine their understanding of beauty through selfies. The workshop is a collaboration between the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities, the 6050 Project, and the East Lansing Public Library. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Donna Kaplowitz of the Residential College about the project.
How did the selfie project come to be?
I happened to view a Dove commercial on a Facebook posting, and the commercial inspired the whole project. Basically, the commercial suggested that we could use social media to reinforce girls' images of beauty and move away from the media stereotypes. At the time that I saw the Dove commercial, I had 8 16-year-olds in my house, and I immediately took them to watch it with me. And they were all so inspired and anxious to participate in something that would help them reclaim ideas about beauty that I was inspired to look for partners to help me bring this to fruition. So I went to some colleagues of mine in the Residential College of Arts and Humanities. I wanted to find somebody who knew about photography and about portraiture. And I also worked with a colleague who does a lot of work around girls' self-esteem. And we put our heads together and went to the East Lansing Public Library, who supported the project from day one, and MSU's 6050 project, which is a year-long project aimed at creating conversation space around issues of human and civil rights. And they embraced the project immediately as well.
So what will girls actually do when they participate in the project?
So we have a workshop set for March 25th from 7 to 9, and they will be led by a group of what I call near peers. They are college students, and so we have a cadre of about 8 or 9 students from MSU who have volunteered to work on this project, and they're going to conduct a 2-hour workshop in which they're going to talk about ideas of beauty that are perpetrated by the media and how those ideas are impossible to achieve because they're digitally enhanced and that nobody really looks like those women in the magazines, and yet we all strive to look for like that. We're going to lead the girls through a series of conversations. We're going to incorporate some poetry into the activities. We're going to have small group breakout sessions to talk about these things. We're going to have larger group discussions. And we're going to end with the photography students and their professor talking about ways to use selfies to take back their ideas of beauty, to think about what they don't like about themselves, and to understand that those things are exactly what makes them unique and beautiful, and to enhance them in the portraits, the selfies that they take during the course of a month. And we're going to ask them to send us their favorite selfie, which we're going to print in large scale, basically make small posters out of everybody's favorite selfie. And we're going to have a gallery opening on April 27th at the public library, where the public will be invited to come and see the results of the girls' work. We're going to also ask the girls to express some reflections on what the experience is like and how they'd like to extend that learning beyond the workshop itself and into real life and with their friends.
So if people want to sign up, how do they go about that?
There is a website. If you go to the East Lansing Public Library website, there's a link to the selfie project, and the girls can sign up. They do need to get their parents' consent with parent email addresses and phone numbers. We do have a limit of 20 girls to participate, but what we've decided is that anybody who comes will be welcome. We just can't guarantee that we have the money to print all of the photographs. We'll do our best. We're still fundraising to try to get more money.
Donna Kapowitz is a professor in the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. Donna, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll hear from the cast of Porgy and Bess at Wharton Center. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features the Capital Area United Way Income Tax Assistance Program. That and more Wednesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. This is 90.5 WKAR.